Larry Grobel has been a freelance writer for more than 40?
I guess you could say I started freelancing in 1970 when I was in the Peace Corps. So 50 years.
He's written for the New York Times, Rolling Stone, Entertainment Weekly, Reader's Digest, Cosmopolitan, Red Book, and Details, and was a contributing editor at Playboy and Hollywood Life. Playboy called him the interviewer's interviewer. Joyce Carol Oates has dubbed him the Mozart of interviewers. Welcome, Larry, once again to the Bibliophile.
Glad to be back, Nigel. It's nice to see you.
So what's interesting is that you have gone from the peak of the interviewing trade to focus your time on writing short stories. Why have you done that? Why didn't you stick with interviewing?
Well, you know, it's interesting. My wife is a weaver, and I said, how come you stop weaving? She says, you know, I've done everything I can in that field. And in a certain way, I remember when Marlon Brando asked me that question. He says, why are you still interviewing people, you know, after a while? You know, and I said, well, because it's never boring to me if someone, because each person has a new story to tell. But the fact is that I would still like to be interviewing on the level I did with Playboy, but they don't, that Playboy doesn't even exist anymore. There's no place to do the kind of interviews I did. The kind of interviews you see now are much shorter. They're more concise. People don't give you that kind of time. So, you know, look, I turned down Sophia Loren because she only was going to give me 6 hours. You know, I mean, that was what I was doing in the Playboy days. I talked to people for days, for months, for, you know, weeks, months, something, you know, I mean, it just went on and on until it was finished. But nowadays, you don't get that kind of time. So my specialty, and I think, you know, what I did was very different than what a lot of interviews are today. I was thinking about that. If you look at the transcripts that I did, I would have 2,000 pages of one interview with, let's say, Al Pacino, 600 pages with Patty Hearst. There's no way that interview is going to be published the way it happened. What you're going to do is you have to edit it. You have to really work on it. It's a total different construct. Now, there are journalists, and they teach in class, you know, oh, you can't do that. You can't edit an interview in that way. There's no other way to do that. There's no other way. You know, nobody has a conversation that is so perfect that you can just, you know, go from the transcription to print. The only one I ever did that was close to that was one I did with Norman Mailer. And that was a 90-minute interview. And almost when I looked at the transcript, I said, you know, he never spoke in double talk. His sentences all made sense. I mean, it was really something to see that, you know, I mean, the way the mind worked. But that was unusual. So my sense was I didn't stop doing interviews. Interviews stopped happening for me. So I would, if tomorrow the New Yorker called and said, hey, we want to start doing Q&As or we want to start doing those interviews, I would go back. I would love to do it. I always said that I would like to do at least two a year for the rest of my life because it allowed me into a person's life in a way that I'd never had access to before. Nowadays, anyway, another answer to that is you don't get to see people because of the pandemic in the last couple of years. If you were doing it, you got to do it on Zoom. I'm an easy person to talk to. So I think I would be the same interview if you were in person with me or on here. But that's not the case with a lot of people. People are reluctant. People can say, oh, you don't like a question. Somehow your Zoom disappears. You know, anything can happen. You don't have control. And control is a very big thing for me when it comes to doing interviews. Now, short stories, why did I start doing them? I always saw myself as a fiction writer, always. Right from the beginning, that was what I wanted to do. I wrote a couple of novels, I put them away, I published two of them. I never was really a short story writer. I wrote a few when I was in Ghana. I wrote a few, you know, I guess before. But for the most part, I never really knew that form. I never mastered the form of short story writing. I was always writing longer. Something happened a couple of years ago. I had a dream, a very strange dream about going into my bathroom. There was like a spider web, but it was a gigantic spider web over the top half of the door, you know, when you walk in. So I saw it Now, I don't know if it's me when I say I, the character in my dream saw it and wanted to get a photograph of it. So grabbed the camera and had to duck underneath this giant web to go inside to take the picture. So he sits on the toilet to take the picture of this web. Now, the web itself is very thick silk, you know, strands, not thin like a spiderweb, but pretty thick. What the person in my dream forgot is that there had to have been a spider to have made that thing, right? So he's sitting there trying to get an angle to take a photograph, and the spider, which happens to be a very large spider. I looked it up. The biggest spiders are about 12, 13 inches. So I made my spiders 18 inches or so, a foot and a half. And he's hiding behind the toilet. And as this guy is taking the photograph, the spider bites him, comes out and bites him on the leg. Poison, you know, but the poison is so strong because it's such a large spider that it goes through his system quickly and he's paralyzed. What happens next? The spider starts to weave a web around him. He just captured him. Now, that's a scary, scary story. You know, I wake up in a sweat, you know, over this thing, right? I say to myself, okay, there's a story here. There's a good story here. What's the story? So, you know, and then I started thinking, who is this guy? And what's, you know, and what kind of guy would it be to make this happen and make it interesting? So I said, well, what if he had everything? What if this is a guy who had everything? The most handsome guy, if he was the most popular guy, if he was the richest guy, you know, all of those things. What and to have it happen to him, right? Why me, God, kind of thing. And then I remembered something that always struck me that Norman Mailer had told me. You know, he says, you know, I asked him about his mother. And he says, my mother was my biggest fan, basically. She was my biggest defender. And, you know, and Norman had like five wives, right? And one of them he stabbed, but his mother always came to his defense. And he says, my mother, if someone said that Norman shot up people on Fifth Avenue, right, with a machine gun, my mother would say, what did they do to him to so anger him to do that? What, that's mother love on an extent that you don't have with anybody else. Nobody's going to be your great defender like that. I'm going to make this guy that guy. That's how this story came about. And so I started to write it, but I started to write it about narcissism. The guy was a great narcissist. And so the story unfolded. I didn't know where it was going. I knew where it was ending. The ending was going to be where he gets bitten and gets, you know, made into a cocoon. Okay. So I wrote this story.
Is one of the reasons you started doing it because what? You were seized by this dream?
That was the absolute reason. That's how that happened. And then I had another dream. I was having a period of an amazing period of dreams. I had a dream about a guy. And now this is not my ending. This is a beginning. A guy who goes to an auction for a carousel, an actual carousel. He gets it. So then I think to myself, okay, so what's he going to do with the carousel? First of all, he wants to put it in his house. What kind of house do you have to put in a carousel? You need at least a 5,000 square foot place just to get the carousel there. So this guy is very wealthy. He lives on a big estate. He gets on the carousel, and what happens to him? I don't know yet. So in my story, I know what happens. He gets on the carousel. Everything's set up. The music starts going, and he starts going back, you know, back in time. So he's on the carousel, and now he's when something bad happened to him, or something he did that was wrong, and he can't get off the carousel until the music stops, and he relives this kind of thing. And he gets off the carousel, gets back on, and does another ride. Same thing, only something else happens, and that with another time in his life. I said, this is another good story idea, right? So, but then I started doing the research. I got a book on carousels. How much is a carousel? Well, a horse, one horse carved at a certain, you know, there's three types of horses, and three of, you know, French and English and American. They can cost you $100,000 for one. You know, so I said, okay, if this guy just bought this carousel, I started to figure out how much it was going to cost him just for the carousel alone was going to be $5 million, let's say. Okay, then he's got to get it to work. I was fascinated by the challenge of making a story out of an idea like this.
That's so interesting. It's that I guess there are different ways that a writer will settle on something to write about. It might be a piece of conversation, something in the newspaper. It might be running into a really interesting character. But in your case, it was dreams. That's interesting.
the strongest dream I ever had, and it's in this book as well. It's in, I put it into this book at the end.
Let's plug the book.
This is the first book, The Narcissist, and my sister-in-law did the this cover
of the spider. Yeah,
she's a famous artist in Japan. She's Japanese. She didn't do it for the book. She just happened to have done the spider. I went, holy mackerel! I found this. Okay, so this was maybe 20 years ago, 15, 20 years ago. I had this dream. It was a very vivid dream. And it was about a young couple, a Peace Corps, two Peace Corps volunteers, a guy and a girl who didn't really know each other well, but they were leaving West Africa. They were their term of duty was up, and they decided to travel together. They go to Mombasa. From Mombasa, you can get a cargo boat to work your way over to India, stopping in the Seychelles Islands first. Now, I know about that because a friend of mine did that. He didn't pay for it. He worked his way over. So I said, okay, that's this. So in my dream, I dreamt about this. But then I said, what happened on the boat? Well, this boat is like Moby Dick. There's Iranians on it. There's Africans. There's everybody but Caucasians. You know, there's just a whole group of different people. And these are young, good-looking, idealistic people. They just served in the Peace Corps for 2 years. Their life is ahead of them. They're 23 years old or whatever. And what happens is that, I don't know how much I want to talk about telling the story, but what happens is basically one of the sailors gets interested in the girl and he attacks her. The guy goes to protect her. He can't protect her because he's not strong enough. And the guy is now beating both of them. The guy, so the Peace Corps volunteer grabs a fire, this extinguisher, and hits the guy on the head, kills him. Now what? What? An idealistic situation. All of a sudden, are they going to believe him? So they end up throwing the guy overboard, right? And now what happens after this? And then they realize that they're starting to be accused. They try to escape. Everything happens. The worst things that could happen to these two couple happens to them. So I woke up with this story and I was in a sweat. It was a very disturbing story. And I remember I wrote down 17 pages of notes about this story. Never did that before. You know, that's a lot. I put it away in a file. Never thought about it again. 3 years go by. I think about this same story comes to me. I had the same dream. I said, oh, my God. And, you know, so now it was a little bit more vivid that now there's a pygmy that's the master, the captain's assistant. And he said he throws bones and he's showing that and all these things are happening. Again, I write it down, but I said, I don't want to think about this story. It's too disturbing because these guys get, you know, my characters get raped by everybody. It's horrible. A couple of years go by. I have the dream a third time. This is true. I've never had a dream like this that repeated itself in such detail, and I don't know why. So anyway, the third time around, I said to myself, you know what? I don't want to have this dream anymore. I better write it. So I write the story, and I wrote it's about a 15 or 20,000 word story. So it wasn't a novel. It was a little bit longer than a short story. I'll call it a novella. And I send the story to Oliver Stone because I had interviewed Stone and, you know, I thought this is a bizarre story, but it may be right up his alley. And sure enough, Oliver Stone calls me up and says, he sends me a note first and he says, I want to talk to you. So then he calls me, he says, come in and see me. The first thing he says is, where did this story come from? You know, I said, I dreamt it. he says to me, okay, look, let's partner this story. He says, I'll produce and maybe I'll direct it. You write it. And we'll go 50-50 on it. And I said to him, Oliver, all my life, I get asked to write things for free on spec. And I said, you know, this is a big assignment. I would love to write this screenplay, but let's not do 50-50. You take 75, give me 25, give me 10, but pay me to write the thing. You know, let's go with it. And he agreed. So he pays me, you know, some money to write it. I go away. I write it. It takes me about 4 or 5 months. In this period of time, Oliver and his partner at, I think it's Exelon Trade Productions or something, the president of his company, they have a falling out. And Oliver makes a decision, I don't want to do anybody else's stories but my own. I get caught in that, right? So I know I get the story back. He says, somebody's going to do this for sure. Well, I never showed it to anybody else. I just put the script away and went on my merry way. Then when I started writing stories like this, I said, okay, maybe I'll put it in my book. You know, I'll do it. I wrote a screenplay, but I added stuff to the screenplay, you know, to the story. But so the story is what it is. But it was all from a dream. And so I saw how powerful dreams can be. The spider one, the carousel one. I had another dream where just being in a toy, in a bathroom, in a high school bathroom, somebody writes, "I'm going to shoot up the school," or something, you know, on the door. Now, I said, "Oh my God," you know, but it was just somebody who was just fucking around. It wasn't like anything that was real. But another boy gets accused of doing the writing of it, and he ends up being expelled. But it was his best friend who wrote it. Okay, so and his friend ends up taking care of him for the rest of his life, but he never knew why, you know, because this kid got expelled. He didn't go to college. Again, I wrote a story called Guilt based on that. So I have some of these stories that were starting to come to me, and I started writing them. I found that I could write them fairly fast because they were on my mind. I was looking forward to getting to it. You know, I mean, it was terrific. And so as I wrote them, I would read them to my wife. And, you know, if she got chills or if she, you know, thought it was, you know, good, great. And then it just one after another. It was like something opened up inside of me that has never happened before like this. It's kind of a creative vein, I guess. And I just started writing these stories. I wrote 25, 30 stories that were in this book. And I, you know, and I thought that was it. But then I started writing some more. So then I ended up writing 35 stories that were in this book, Schemers, Dreamers, Cheaters, and Believers. A lot of them are political. A lot of them are what, you know, they're either things that are happening in my life, dealing with old age or aging, dealing with relationships, dealing with what's, you know, my grandson had cancer. He's 2 years old. And he goes through chemotherapy for two straight years till he's four. We drive up there. We're angry because we're dealing now with the Stanford Children's Cancer thing, and we see how incompetent they are. And my daughter's a doctor, so she was able to, you know, see what was going on and say, "You don't have the needle in right, or you this is not happening, or you didn't have this." She kept finding faults that she was catching. And I'm thinking, what would be about the people who are not catching these things because they're totally trusting in doctors who are making mistakes? And so like, what, my God, I said, this is, and it was angry, you know, the doctor taking care of our grandson, he disappears for all of a sudden. He has a crack up. We don't know if he's mentally ill or if something happened. They won't tell you. Your doctor disappears. They don't tell you why. Nobody even says anything. So he's gone for this week. He's gone for this month. He's gone. What the heck? We need to know. We need to know. Should we be changing his medication? Is he going? There are three types of chemo that we're dealing with. We're taking which stage by stage? When do you change? It was really, really frustrating. So I wrote, you know, I got out my frustrations. I wrote a story called Glow about, you know, when you finally say, I want to try radioactive, you know, what a thing. So I had to read about what you can do when you're desperate about certain things. So that story is very touching. It made me cry when I wrote it. It makes me cry when I read it. There's a number of stories about a young boy going through, you know, this kind of stuff. Well, that was based on the emotions I was feeling about, you know, what was going on with my grandson. So these stories just seem to come from different places in my mind, you know, but it's just a wonderful way of getting out something creatively. You know, you had written me a note just a few minutes before we started talking, and you said you want to compare doing interviews with writing short stories. And I said to myself, well, that there's no comparison. It's not true. There's no comparison at all. And then I thought, you know, I only have had a little while to think about it, but there is quite a lot of comparison to it in a certain way.
I just have a few things to say about what you've just said. First of all, it sounds like your inspiration really has been things that you're passionate about, that you've become emotionally engaged with, that are important to you, so, or that have come to you in a dream. I'm going to quote Elizabeth Hardwick here in an interview that she did for the Paris Review quite a long time ago in the 50s. Here's what she says about writing fiction and inspiration. You have to create the text, but it's a struggle. A struggle seems to be to uncover things by language, to find out what you mean and feel by the sheer effort of writing it down. Things that are vague in the beginning have to be made concrete. Often what you thought was the creative idea ahead of you vanishes or becomes something else.
I agree with that. Absolutely.
So the questioner then asks, is it a concept? Is it a character? Is it a scene? And she responds that it's different for each piece of work. Might be a single line that she had in her head. Might even be the notion of an ending. She then says that a question about the opening paragraph. Should it be mostly concerned with the mood or plot or character? And here's what Hardwick said, just to get to your point about openings.
Right.
She says, I think it's mood. No, I mean tone. Tone arrived at by language. I can't write a story or an essay until I can, by revision after revision, get the opening tone right. Sometimes it takes forever, but when I have it, I can usually go on. You agree with that?
Joseph Heller told me that he could not write a book, any of his novels, he says, until he got the first paragraph right. And I know with Something Happened, he quoted about, you know, in the place where I live, there are five people that I fear or something. So he says, well, that gives you the sense that if he's working in a big building, you know, with a lot of employees like Time Magazine or whatever, that five is not that many, you know? So in other words, he's fairly high up. It tells you something. Turns out that he uses that in the second chapter of his book, I believe, but that's how he started. You know, he couldn't get started until that happened. Truman Capote, on the other hand, always told me that he always wrote the ending first. So he wrote towards the ending. Nice trick. But the beginning of the story, when I teach short story writing, and I've just started doing that when I'm at the Rancho La Puerta, I do this different kind of workshops. But the short story one, I kept thinking, how am I going to get people to, in just 3 days, to write a short story? They're so frightened about it. They don't know where to begin. That's what hangs them up a lot. You know, where do I go with it? So I thought, I went through all the stories in my house, you know, all the books I have on by everybody, world's greatest short stories, this, that, whatever. And I looked at just the opening line of all these stories. And what I would do is I had people pick a line, right? And this is your story. I said, I want you to write. I don't tell them who wrote it. Later I will, but right now it's just the line. And the line could be, I once saw a bloke trying to kill himself. Or besides the neutral expression that she wore when she was alone, Mrs. Freeman had two others, forward and reverse, that she used for all her human dealings. Okay, that's Flannery O'Connor. The first one was from Alan Sillitoe. Burton knew what the dentist would notice first, the clerical collar. People always did. That's John Updike. Okay, so I give them, let's say, that kind of line. And then I said, write a story based on, you know, with that opening. And then when they finish, I said, okay, take out that first line and you've got yourself a story. Put up another line there. And now go to John Updike or Flannery O'Connor or whoever and see what they wrote about it. And it works. Everybody wrote a really interesting story. She was one of those pretty girls and pretty and charming girls born as though fate had blundered into a family of clerks. That's from The Necklace by Guy de Maupassant. You know, I mean, my father came across the field carrying the body of the boy who had been drowned. Alice Munro. So what I'm saying is that the first lines are very, you know, for myself, when I looked at my opening lines, one of the lines is, someone is trying to poison me. That's what I wrote down. Okay, who, what, why? You know, I'm writing a story now. I'm trying to. I just had the title "Cancel Culture." Okay, that was going to be my title. I wanted to deal with it because I don't understand cancel culture. I don't even know who's on the right side or the wrong side. I'm trying to figure all of this out and what's going on today. And so I write this down. But then as I started writing the story, it turns out that a policeman is calling a woman and said, I'm trying to find Edith Monroe or something. She says, I'm sorry, she's not here. She doesn't live here anymore. Well, aren't you Edith Monroe? No. Who are you? My name is Cancel Culture. Her name is Cancel Culture. What the heck am I doing here? So I'm having fun now, right? And then it's like, you know, so I've written about 9 pages of this. I have no idea where it's going. She has a friend. I mean, it's kind of crazy. But somewhere along the line, my mind is always thinking about these things. Because this one I'm having a tough time with. I take walks. oftentimes I take a walk around my neighborhood for an hour, and I think about these story ideas, what I'm writing, when the middle, and then the ending will come, or the something in the middle, or a character changes, and I run back because I always forget to bring a notebook with me. It's my worst fault. I got to run back and write this down. So you don't know. I agree that, you know, I mean, to me, the opening, the tone, the opening line, if you don't have a good opening, no one's going to read the rest of the story. It's just not going to happen.
Right. We've got the opening. How do you keep them reading?
Because you're entertaining yourself along the way. You're trying to figure out what that opening is. Where is this person going? One character says, Dotson had no idea what the carousel built in the 1930s would go for at the auction. That was my opening line. Now, where do you go with that? Django lived in a constant state of anxiety. This is a story I call Living with an Assassin. Now, how did that story come about? One day I had a thought. I said, your heart is an assassin. Because I thought about the idea of a heart attack killing you, right?
And you never know when it's going to hit you, right?
Exactly. So I wrote down that line on a piece of paper, this big, you know, about, right. I find that on my bedside desk, you know, I have papers all over. I stumble on that line maybe 10 years, 5 years later. I find this line. And I'm thinking about it. I said, oh, your heart, that's an idea. I sat down to write that story. I don't know where that story is, but the first word came to my mind was Django. Django. Right. So now to me, the minute I write Django, I'm already in Africa. You know what I mean? So I'm writing a story about somebody in Africa who's afraid that's, you know, that. And then what's the story about? This story just unfolded in a really interesting way. But I didn't know where that was going, paragraph by paragraph.
I think that might be the key right there, is that in writing it, you don't know where it's going, and nor does the reader, but the reader and you want to find out. That's what keeps them reading, obviously.
Do you think you could be a school shooter? Jeb asked his four friends as they watched news about the latest school massacre on MSNBC. So I said, okay, who are these people? Well, it turns out they said, no, none of them thought they could be a shooter, but they did think that they could burn down Los Angeles. These are Beverly Hills High School students. These are privileged kids. And it's called Windblown, because they start planning out, what if we wanted to burn down Los Angeles? How could we do that? Well, there's seven different like national forests and areas that you could actually go to. I mapped this all out, by the way. It's a very disturbing story. But they map out these things and say, if the Santa Ana winds are blowing and it's more than 50 miles an hour, and you set fires in these seven areas, the fires will sweep across Los Angeles. It's very possible you'd burn down Los Angeles. Okay, and right into Santa Monica. So then these kids are, you know, but they're playing with it as an idea. They're not thinking they're really going to do it. Except once the Santa Ana is about to come, they're about to graduate. Some of these kids have had, you know, one kid didn't get into college, so he's a little bit pissed off. One kid's father has an affair with the other kid's mother. So these kids are angry. They're pissed off, even though they're privileged, with what they're seeing. And they decide, and the end of the story is, let's do it. But you don't know if they're going to do it. You don't know if it's going to succeed, but they have planned this thing out. And I said, oh, you know, I even thought, don't publish this story. You know what I mean? Don't give people ideas.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, you know, look, this is what you do, right? Is, you know, one of the most disturbing stories I've written was I Like to Kick. And it's based on, you know, my wife is an Asian. And what was going on in New York when that guy attacked the Asian woman, the older Asian woman, it was a, you know, and he knocked her down and started kicking her, right? Thinking she's Chinese, I guess. And I'm thinking, what kind of a person attacks a woman and then just keeps kicking her in the stomach, in the head? I don't understand that. But I wrote the person as a first person story. I was that kicker.
Because you wanted to understand it.
Exactly. I did the same thing with the Proud Boys. I did the same thing. You know, the Proud Boys ended up being a bunch of boys who, you know, aren't the Proud Boys you think. I have a story called Saving Mike Pence. I wanted to title this book Saving Mike Pence. And everybody said, if it has the word Mike Pence, then no one's going to want it. Right. I said, yeah, but it's not about Mike Pence. It's about the guy with the horns. It's totally. Him, you know, it's about. So I wrote that story. So I write these stories.
So what? So you know, there's a, I guess there's a motivation to understand, and there is a motivation to what? Help improve society?
Yes, in a certain way. If you can make sense out of chaos in any way you can, maybe that does work. You know, I have characters who want, you know, a husband, 75-year-old husband says, I'm getting a gun. The wife says, no, you're not. You know, no, we need, when the revolution comes, who's going to have all the guns? The people on the right, the people who are, you know, we're going to be captive. We need to protect ourselves. And she says, you can't even, you know, you lose your glasses. A gun will go off in the house. I don't. And they start fighting over the nature of that. Right. But all of the stories that happen, I respond to what's going on around me.
It sounds like what you're doing is there's typically some sort of conflict, anger, or there's an emotion that you're trying to harness in a way that entertains as well as stimulates thought.
Yeah, it's a response to the times, you know, in a certain way. Yeah. There's one that I call It Ain't Me, Babe. This one works very well when I read it out loud. This is how it begins. It's bad enough I'm often mistaken for an armadillo or an anteater or a sloth or an aardvark or even a possum. I mean, come on, humans. There are a hell of a lot of differences between us, but this time around, it's been way too much. Going about my business, sniffing and scratching out a life away from you humans, and then becoming the focus of your pandemic. Not just the focus, but the cause of it, transferring from me to you. Huh, that's a laugh, as if I had the power to do any such thing. I'm not a bat. I don't live in dark, wet caves. I can't fly, so I don't cover great distances. Not so great distances. I'm just a pangolin, as you have named me, or a zift, as we call each other. My legs are small and thick, my claws long, my body low to the ground, and my nose highly sensitive to what's going on under it. I don't mate outside my species, yet I'm a high-end item on the outdoor markets. So how do you think I got the virus that has killed so many of you? I didn't get it. I didn't do it. I'm tired of being impugned. And then it goes on. It's called It Ain't Me, Babe. And in the end, it ain't me, babe, it's you, humans. You know, once I got the idea of a pangolin, I didn't even know really what a pangolin quite looked like. I looked it up. I did the research.
Right.
And then I wrote the story. So, yeah, I'm responding to a lot of stuff that's going on around. You know, it's like I'm not writing my journalism. You know, normally I would be talking to Mike Pence. I would be talking to Elizabeth Warren or Cheney. I would love to, you know, she'd be a terrific one to talk to, but I'm not doing that. I'm doing it in a different way. I'm responding to the times by, you know, writing about the characters that are making us watch the news all the time. Right. And it's all disturbing. How do you make sense out of the destruction of this country? And that's what I see is happening in America, is I think we're losing it. I think we're losing our democracy. I think the idea that Trump could even come back is astounding to me. You know, that in a certain way, I want him to run because we know what he did. We see it so upfront. All the Democrats the Republicans that might have a chance at winning, if they have to support Trump, they're going to lose. That's what I'm hoping for, because that's the only way that makes sense to me. But if they win, then this country is going down, and that's a shame. But in the end, it's what we deserve. And you sort of look at, maybe there's a reason you need a strong man, a dictator, because a strong man can say, you know, if there's an outbreak of a pandemic anywhere, the whole city closes down. If you go out in the street, we'll shoot you. Okay, we'll hang you if you do something wrong. That's what's being done in certain countries. You know, in Iran, that's being done. It's done, you know, Afghanistan today.
It seems to me, again, that you're clicking in to this deeply human desire to understand what's going on here. Why you're writing is to try and make sense out of stuff. And you want good writing is taking people along on that ride. And maybe they're hoping for some kind of answer at the end. That's what keeps them reading is, hey, maybe he's got an answer for me.
Maybe this is the guy who got the answers. I do have answers, you know, but they don't necessarily mean that you're going to agree with it in the end. You know, I wrote a story called The Accused. You know, I taught at UCLA for 10 years. You had to take you had to answer questions. You had to go on a sensitivity thing to show that you understand. You can't touch a student. You can't make any kind of propositions. You got to talk in a certain way, whatever. Now, I had situations when I was at UCLA where if a young woman came into my office, I always kept the door open. I remember I had a student once who was pregnant. You know, she was an older woman. She's not older, older. She was like 25 or 30, let's say. And she was having a bad day. She came to see me, and I started to walk with her in the hallway at UCLA in the English class. And she started to cry. And I put my arm around her. And then I immediately pulled my arm back. My natural instinct is to be a concerned person. I'm not trying to do any. She's pregnant, for God's sake. But, you know, I realized we're in that kind of place where, you know, you have to be so careful about things. It's crazy. Now, when I was at Antioch, I had a student, and this is a true story. I have never written about this story, about this woman. She was a young woman. She was a little bit touched, I guess, you know, a little nuts. But anyway, I had my office. Anybody could go into my office. I didn't lock it. It was, you know, but I was the director of this program, and I was outside. I come back in, and my door was closed. I open my door, and there is this young woman naked. She's naked. And I go, what's the matter? What are you doing? She says, I always have sex with all my professors, all my teachers. That's her thing. I said, put your clothes on. I said, I'm going to walk out, put your clothes on, you know. And I ended up taking her to my house where my wife was, you know, because she lived in Calabasas. She lived very far away. And I thought she may have been drunk. I didn't know what it was. But I thought, you know, I had a concern. I let her stay in our guest room, you know, and I tried to talk to her. But, you know, I mean, if anybody had walked in, and now this was years ago, this was in the late 70s already. So this is not like we're the Me Too. But if that happened now, you know, so I've thought about oftentimes about this, the idea of being wrongly accused of anything. So I have this a woman who wrote a story in my class. I didn't care for the story. And I thought that it needed a lot of work. And I wrote, you know, I spent a lot of time giving my comments. For what it's worth, if you don't like it, you know, you're a writer. Forget what the person said. I gave her my thoughts, gave her a B, maybe even a B plus. I don't remember, probably a B. And she comes in and she says, how dare I criticize that story? Mona Simpson, pretty well-known writer. She says, Mona Simpson read the story. She loved it. She loved it. I said, is this a story you gave to her too? I said, did you get a grade on that? I said, you know, so that now I'm going to lower your grade because she didn't write me a new story. You wrote me something, you know, Then I said, listen to her. Don't listen to me. It's okay. No, but you're going to kill my average. You're going to, you know, I said, you're going to write three more stories. She was adamant about it. And I really never liked giving out A's unless they deserved them. I'm still of that school.
It's
where
the way it should be.
It's not the way it is. All these kids get, you know, it's horrible. There's a Harvard professor, I forget who he was. He said he gives out two grades. He gives them the grade they'll get and then the grade they deserve, right? And the day they deserve, it's like a C. And they'll get an A for the thing so they can keep going. But that's why we're producing people who aren't that smart going into graduate schools, you know, because they're not. But anyway, in this case, I thought about this and I kind of thought of her and this idea that coming in and accusing, you know, because she's not getting the grade she wants, she accuses him of sexual harassment. And if that happened, that's what the school would do. The school would put the teacher on hiatus until it's investigated, which means he's no longer teaching and he's got to defend himself. And how do you defend yourself when it's one-on-one and a student and you have to take the student's word for it and more than the teacher's in this kind of situation? So in my story, though, I do a kind of twist in the end, is that I end up having him publish her later on when he, you know, even though he loses his job and he does the right thing. She takes the story. He edits it.
I'm reading this as a male. You've written it as a male, but the very end, it's basically she's pissed off because he didn't pay attention to her cleavage. And that's not politically correct, Larry.
I know. I love that ending.
If I'm a woman reading that, my story might piss me off.
Well, listen. If I can't piss off people for my writing, then why write? I remember once when I was teaching a class, a memoir writing class, right? And you sit around. There's 16 students sitting around a long table, and basically it's a workshop. So people would read what they had to write. So one girl, young lady. She starts to read her story, and it's a very emotional story. And in the middle of it, she just can't go on. She starts to cry, and she gets up and runs out of the room, right? She can't even deal with it. And that some of the students said to me, "Professor," I love when they called me professor because I really wasn't one. You know, I was a lecturer, but why didn't you stop her, you know, before, you know? And I said, "Are you kidding? Are you kidding?" I said, "I would like all of you to write a kind of piece that would get you so emotional that you can't even finish reading it. That's what good writing is. It's emotional. It brings out something in you. That's where I'm going with this stuff. I'm trying to get you to do that kind of stuff." And it really worked. It snapped. And then they started writing all this emotional stuff. Like, you know, it's like, great. But, you know, to me, you got to be a little angry, you know, when you read a story. You got to be, you know, look, nobody makes me angrier than James Joyce because I can't understand him. I read Finnegan's Wake. He's making me
feel so... That's a good way to go crazy.
Yeah. I mean, you know, look, for years, I didn't write fiction because of Joyce, because I kept trying to... I wrote a couple of novels when I was younger and I would put them aside. And whenever I finished them, I said to myself, "It's not as good as James Joyce. It's not as good as Portrait of the Artist," which is just the beginning, right? Not going up to the others. So I would put it aside. And then one day it occurred to me, and I may have talked to you about this before, I don't know, but it occurred to me, I had an epiphany, a Joycean epiphany. And what was my epiphany? I'm not a genius. That's the epiphany. I can't write like James Joyce. I can't write like Hemingway or Fitzgerald. I'm not that. I am who I am, and I have to find my own voice and write what I write, and that has to be good enough for me, because it's as good as I can do. As long as I'm writing as what I think is as good as I can do, then I've got to be happy with it. And I've learned to live with myself over the years because of that. But for a long time, I was trying to, you know, compare myself to the greatest writers of all time.
Just allow me to get to this comparison between I'm just gonna lay down some of the stuff that I think helps to make an interview interesting, and then we'll flip it over to you for how do you relate it to writing the short story. So first of all, in an interview, obviously you introduce the person that you're gonna interview, and that sets down a certain credentials and credibility so that the listener wants to listen because they know that this person should have interesting stuff to say. You do the research and you've taken the inspiration. You haven't just sort of jumped ahead with that on its own. You've researched specifics. So then you go to read the book. You would bring up points for clarification and perhaps focus on passages that delight you. You would look and try to bring out interesting facts, new takes on things, and some good laughs. Ideally, you as the interviewer want to learn something as you go along and feel something and have fun.
I would add one more important thing to what I look at for an interview, and that is, and again, I'm talking about print interviews, and you're talking about listening and talking, you know, verbal.
Yes.
You know, and I've done both. I've done the cable TV interviews for Playboy, but to me, it's a different ballgame. What we're doing now is different
totally
than what you're doing
because
you're editing. But what I always look for in an interview is to reach a point with the person who to talk about something, to give us an insight into something we don't ever know before. We never knew before about that person. I try to go deeper into an area that I have read about. If someone talks about, gee, the inspiration for me to write this was, I looked at the moon when it was going into an eclipse and that gave me the story. I would then go into astronomy with that person. I would go a little bit deeper than just the moon and the astronomy. I say, well, why the moon and not the sun eclipse? Why this? Why? Trying to get them to think a little bit deeper themselves about why they did or where they went. Why are you reading this interview if everything you're hearing has already been in print somewhere
totally,
else?
Totally, yeah. Know? You want to make it matter too, don't you? You want to make it matter.
Yes.
And
exactly.
You want the person who's reading it or listening to it to think, Oh, good. I didn't waste my time. This was a good use of my
exactly. I always looked at my interviews as this is going to be the interview of record. If you're going to look at 50 or 100 interviews of Al Pacino or John Huston or Pavarotti, the one you're going to go to, the one you're going to, you know, single out is mine. That's before I even interviewed the person. That's what I'm going for. And in a lot of ways, that's the way it is, because whenever there's a documentary now being done on television with Steve Martin, with Robin Williams, with Dolly Parton, with Patty Hearst, they always get in touch with me. And they, you know, end up using some of my interview, and they pay me thousands of dollars for a minute or two, you know, of what I've done. Yes, I say you can get it. If you can get it elsewhere, get it. Because I always, if I was going to do something, I wanted it to be the best it could be. And I wanted to be the best I could be, you know.
Okay, so let's flip this over to short stories then. You've heard what I've just said with the interview, and the key is to keep people's interest. So can you just take what I've said and sort of flip it on top of the short story?
The thing that I do in interviewing is I have to find my opening. I have to find that beginning to bring you right in. And once I get that opening, then I'm spending an awful lot of time getting the next question and answer. Because if the person is saying, the time I almost killed my brother was when I jumped, you know, when he was about to jump off a building, blah, blah, blah. Okay, I caught your attention. He just saved his brother. But now the next question has to be something to do with family, right? Or something. So now I have to go through all my indexes to find the next, you know, what he talked about later that we may have talked about 5 days later about his brother, or about them. How does his mother feel about it? Then once you did the mother, then what does your father feel? You know, so you're basically adding on to it, but you're making it look seamless. Each question and answer looks like a conversation. You don't want to break it up. Same thing with a short story. You get the opening. Someone's trying to poison me. The next thing is who? Who's trying to poison you? The next thing is why? You know, I mean, so you're building that story as you write it.
Again, that's what we're looking for, right? Is an answer.
Right.
Is that it?
The answer comes in as the story unfolds, because you're finding out the answer, and someone trying to poison me. Maybe he thinks it's Vladimir Putin who's trying to poison him, and you know, because now I'm getting into my politics, right? Because it's crazy with Putin poisoning.
Yeah, yeah.
And because he's now, I said, well, how could that be? What if he's married to a Russian woman? What if the Russian woman says that Putin is his, you know, is a late an uncle of hers? You know, she's like, is she crazy?
Right.
You know, and he says, well, maybe it's my mother who's trying to poison me. Oh, I just got a whole other thing going on now. And what if they all live together in the same house? What if the father can't stand it? So the story just unfolds.
No, but it doesn't just unfold. You're following your kind of curiosity about your own stuff. So you're feeding your own mind stuff that then asks questions about what you fed it.
I often feel, Nigel, that I don't know what I think until I write about it. Do you remember, I don't know if you ever heard This I Believe? It used to be on NPR. It's like a 10-minute thing that NPR did. They did it. Then they made two books out of it too. But they were wonderful. They got Yo-Yo Ma on it. They got all sorts of different people. And it's what they believed. And it was like 500 words or something. But they would read it on the radio. And I thought about that. And I said, I'd like to submit This I Believe to see what, you know. And I started to think about it. And I couldn't figure out what I believe. Every time I came up with an idea, I said, oh, I believe this. I contradicted it, right? I believe in ice cream. I believe in ice cream. Okay, but it's fattening. Maybe it's not so good. I believe in coffee ice cream, my favorite ice cream. But I also like to mix it with, you know, everything I had a mix. I would change it. And I finally came up with one thing that I truly believe. Okay. And what it was that I was the luckiest man alive. Why? Because I had chosen the right woman to marry. And I have had a very good life because of it. So now it was going to be about her. So I wrote this thing and I sent it in.
It's beautiful. Yeah. That is.
But what happened is that they did away with this, I believe. It went off the air right before. But I use it as a writing assignment. I give it out to students. And I, you know, to me, it's like, what is it that I believe? What do I really think of Donald Trump? What do I really think? I mean, I think I'm angry with, I think of this, I think of that, but the guy got elected. He got 70 million voters. I mean, something's going on in this country. What is cancel culture? What is Me Too? Where do I fit in? What do I think about it? If I talk to you about it, I don't think I'm as clear as if I write about it. So if you want to know what I believe, read my short stories, read what these, you know, that's what I believe. In some one way or another, I'm coming to grips with it. And that, you know, so yes, in a certain way, writing a short story becomes easier than doing an interview the way I was doing it, because I was dealing with thousands and thousands of pages and trying to make it look like a play. I was trying to give you a beginning. I was trying to get you interested in it. Then I was trying to move you along. And then so it goes down like a graph, and then it goes back up, and then something happens, and then there's a problem, and then there's a challenge, and it has to be met. And then that challenge is met. And then you get it. Where's your ending? How is this going to end? And I never knew where my ending was until I was working on it. And it was thought of appear. And then the person would say something. I said, that's it. That's the end. I always would make sure I have good endings. Well, the same thing with writing short stories. You start writing it and you start seeing you're developing it. But somewhere along the line, as you develop it, it's not going to be as exciting. It's because you got to give some information about it. You got to talk about the nature of a carousel of a horse. Well, that no matter what you write about it, it's not going to be anything unless the horse comes to life, that's something else. But if it's just a static horse, you're going to write about a little bit of a history here. But then it's going somewhere, and it's, you know, and as it unfolds, you're seeing what moves you. And then when you finish a story, yes, you read it out loud, you put it away for a few days, you come back to it, and you see every time you wrote the word which, you mean to write the word that. You know, I mean, you change things, you fix it up, you make it better. And sometimes you overwrite and you want to cut out a few things. And that's the nature of writing, you know, fiction or nonfiction. I think I said, and I think this is the one thing I wrote about in The Art of the Interview. I said, let me see if I can get it. Putting together a good interview involves many skills. One must be able to converse like a talk show host, think like a writer, understand subtext like a psychiatrist, have an ear like a musician, be able to select the best parts like a book editor, and know how to piece it together dramatically like a playwright.
Larry, you said that before. Yeah. On the previous interview.
Right. Listen, who's going to listen to two of these things? But
they are. But
what I'm saying is, you know, I didn't know about that until I was writing about interviews, when I started thinking about all that thing. But yes, the same thing applies to short story writing. You know, you have to think about something first. You know, now you don't have to, you know, talk like a talk show host. You don't need that, because you're writing, you're talking to yourself here. But you do have psychological senses about what a good interview is going to be, or a good story is going to be. You do have subtext, you know, you are looking at things in a certain way. I'm writing about a pangolin who's complaining, but what I'm really writing about is a pandemic that we're going through, and searching for answers. And in the end, the answer is it's our own fault that these things happen. You know, we aren't careful enough.
You talked about writing about what you believe, or trying to figure that out. And it seems to me that what would keep people reading would be, yes, it's interesting to see his thought process and how he's getting to what he believes. But at the end, it's like, okay, do I believe that or not? Do I agree with him? And, you know, so I suppose that's part of it too, engaging that way. But anyway, let's close with Chekhov, okay? I want to close with Chekhov here.
Okay, Chekhov's a good guy to close with.
and what he believed, okay? Or at least how he approached things. And here it is. The acceptance of a rather shapeless kind of short narrative implying the forlornness of man, morally flabby creature that he is, in a world that he never made.
Well, that's Chekhov.
And, that's Chekhov, but Chekhov is brilliant. Like, Chekhov's one of the best.
Chekhov may be, yeah. He's got a, you know, in any list of the best.
His outlook. That's his outlook. He leaves things, doesn't give you any kind of conclusion. it's kind of like the world out there. There are questions. There aren't so many answers. It's just, and it's complex.
Of course it's complex. In stories, we find ourselves, you know, I cannot imagine a life without writing stories, without writing something. You know, I mean, I just can't imagine. I can't, you know, did Hemingway kill himself because finally he felt his stories weren't working? His mind wasn't working to the point that he couldn't write stories. You know, I mean, it's like, to me, it's food, it's energy.
It helps you think.
It makes you live. Think, right. That's what I was saying. You know, I don't know what I think. You know, there's certain things that I just love. I mean, here's Donald Barthelme from The King of Jazz. And I just love the rhythm of it. Well, I'm the king of jazz now, thought Hokey Mokey to himself as he oiled the slide of his trombone. Now, how can you not like that?
Yeah, I'm jumping around with that.
And then, you know, I mean, then who was one of the great short story writers? I was sick unto death with that long agony. And when they at length unbound me and I was permitted to sit, I felt that my senses were leaving me. That's from The Pit and the Pendulum, right? Edgar Allan Poe. And then the other one, the thousand injuries of Fortunato I had borne as best I could. But when he ventured upon insult, I vowed revenge. Cask of Amontillado. The opening line, do you not go the next time to read the next sentence? You know?
Yeah.
My first day in hell is drawing to a close. Jack Handy, my first day. Here's one that I wrote. But for the sex, they lived like monks in silence.
That's contradictory and complex.
And it's also very personal. I thought, you know, I mean, it's like, okay, you know, what's happening and what happens to a relationship after 50 years of marriage? You know, I mean, yeah, you don't have to talk too much anymore because you know each other so well that you think each other's thoughts. So anyway, yes, it's all I can say is I think that there's a great deal of excitement and in keeping your creative juices alive. I think this is why we live, really, is to be able to express, to be able to feel alive in the expression. And it doesn't have to be through writing. It could be through painting. It could be through crafts. It could be through gardening. But people have to have a passion to want to keep on going. And if you don't have passion in something, you live a very dull life, you know. You live a life, okay, come to an end, and you accept it. Like Zorba the Greek, you know, I mean, Kazantzakis, I want to leave death a bag of bones, man. You know, I want to live my life to its fullest. So when I'm gone, it's, you know, I've exhausted this body, you know, in whatever right. way.
Yeah. Well, just speaking of passion, I'll just end on, this is Laurie Moore here. She's talking about a novel is a daily labor over a period of years. A novel is a job, but a story can be like a mad, lovely visitor with whom you spend a rather exciting weekend.
I try to. Well, they say one of the definitions of a story is a piece of writing that can be read in one sitting. Let's say between 2,500 and 5,000 words. You know, I've sent some of my work to Joyce Carol Oates once, and once in a while I talk to her about things like that. But, you know, she always wants me to flesh things out more. And I always want to, I say, do you need to know more than that? You know, I mean, yeah. I feel like if there's enough there to give you a sense of what the story's about.
You want the reader to participate. But so, Larry, how do people get at your stories? What's the easiest way for them to do that?
Well, the easiest way is just to go on Amazon and put in Lawrence Grobel, and just up will come all of my books. Now, what I say to people is, if you go on and do this, every single book that you click on has a look inside feature.
Oh,
so
yes.
At the top of the book, you press on that, you look inside, you get 10% of the book. If you click on the Houstons, you get 80 pages. I hate that. It's an 850-page book, but you get the first 80 pages of the book. You can read it. Okay, if you do the short stories, though, you'll be able to at least get one short story to read for free. If you like the story, then you may want to get the other 35 of them. You know, how much are these things? It's less than 50 cents a story, basically. It's like, well, you think about it. I spend a year writing something, and for 10, 15 bucks, you know, you're getting the book. Let me just plug my newest book, which is a book called Turquoise, and then we can go. Sure. But this book, I copied the cover from James Joyce's Ulysses.
It's a teal color.
Yeah, yeah. It's a picture I took of the ocean in Tahiti. So, yeah, and this is it's an interesting story in itself. I was writing my short stories. I was looking for some stories I wrote when I was in Ghana. I found them in a file, and I used three of them in the last book, Stuck. But I also found underneath that a manuscript that I had written when I was in Ghana, and it was called Turquoise. And Turquoise is based on something a sculptor said to me, Vincent Kofi, when I asked him what the truth in art is. And he said, truth is like the color turquoise. It changes under different light. And he's right. Nice. So I thought, this is my truth. My truth. I wrote a book about my, all these are vignettes. They're all three pages long, and it goes on for 400 pages. But I thought a Ghanaian who would read this would say, this is not the way Accra is. This isn't the way Africa is, because he grew up there. I'm coming in from the outside. This is what I saw in the 3 years I was there. So it was my truth. It's my turquoise. So that was where the title came from. But the book really covers all, it brought back so vividly when the times I was dancing in the streets of Winneba during a festival, the time a Juju man, you know, I had a fight with him because he wanted to curse the money that my houseboy wanted for a bed that he said was stolen. I mean, there's so many stories that I got involved with. I went to the school of the blind, the school of the deaf. I went to fetish priestess ceremonies. You know, I went to Mali and to Dahomey and, in Ganvi, where the people live in the water on stilted houses. All of that is in there. It's a remarkable kind of story. And it's a love story because I had a girlfriend there that was Ghanaian, and she was like, you know, and I was very close to her. She became very famous, by the way. She's still alive. So this is the book I published after 52 years of sitting on my inside. And I just reworked it a little bit and put it out. And I'm very pleased with it. So that's my little plug, Turquoise. Besides Stuck and Schemers, Dreamers, Cheaters and Believers, and the other one, The Narcissist, short stories. So is it a pleasure talking to you?
You're so full of energy and ideas. I know that extends itself to the page. Thank you for sharing your stories. It was a pleasure.
You too. Thank you, Nigel. Okay. Nice to talk to you.